So I think with that, we're going to get ready to turn things over. Again, this is the Vapor Intrusion Site Issues Internet Seminar, which is being sponsored by the OSC Readiness Training Program, where this month we're going to cover a number of topics that are related to emergency response and cleanup actions that will be presented by EPA On-Scene Coordinators, or OSCs. Today's session is actually going to cover 2 hours from a much larger class. It's about 8 hours long, where we teach techniques for addressing site issues that have vapor intrusion originating from contaminated groundwater or soils. And when we go through this particular course, the instructors will cover topics ranging from an overview of vapor intrusion and current guidance, looking at sampling procedures, where they'll talk about groundwater issues, and look at a number of case studies or site examples. They're going to cover lectures, case studies, and we'll go through questions at the end. Again, this is just a 2-hour shortened version of a larger 8-hour course. So we're going to turn things over to our two instructors today. We have two OSCs, or on-scene coordinators, that are coming from EPA Region 5. We have Steve Renninger, who's coming out of – Steve, are you in Cincinnati?
Yes, that's correct.
And Kevin Turner, who's an OSC coming out of the Region 5 office in Illinois?
Yes, Southern Illinois.
Okay. So with that, I think I'm going to turn things off again. Reminder to keep your phone lines on mute. Everyone should be looking at slide number one.
Thanks, Jean. I'm on slide number one. Welcome to the Vapor Intrusion webinar. As Jean mentioned, we originally put this course together last February for the OSC Readiness Conference. It's a 4-hour course that we've now condensed to 2 hours. We're in the process of updating the course, and we'll be presenting it again at readiness training this coming February. Moving to slide number two, I'm Steve Renninger. I'm an on-scene coordinator in Region 5 and have been for 20 years. I'm co-located with the National DECON team and the Environmental Response team in Cincinnati, Ohio.
And I'm Kevin Turner. I also am a OSC in Region 5. I live in Southern Illinois, cover Southern Illinois and Southern Indiana as an outstationed OSC. Next slide.
Slide number three is the agenda that we're going to follow today. Kevin and I are going to cover a brief introduction to vapor intrusion. The second module will be a case study. We're going to throw you right into a case study to show you investigation options, sampling issues, screening levels, mitigation. That will be a VOC case example that we're going to share with you from Ohio. The third module will be health issues. Normally this is taught by ATSDR, but Kevin and I will be covering the health issues. Fourth module will be the groundwater issues, normally taught by ERT, but Kevin and I are going to cover that today.
Then we'll jump into Hartford, Illinois. That's on the Illinois side of St. Louis. Case study. We'll do some sampling procedures. This is a section that is again normally covered by ERT, and we have a shortened version of that. We'll get into some what's called a vapor intrusion toolbox, and that is something that we put together for Region 5. It's web-based, and it's kind of a one-stop shop for various documents and guidance and things of that nature related to vapor intrusion. We'll get into some vapor intrusion guidance, and then we'll, if time allows, have questions. Slide number four. Our course objectives here. The first two bullets here I'm going to kind of cover, I'm going to intermingle them together. This is not EPA policy. This is material that was put together by OSCs for OSCs. So I know we've got probably a wide variety of folks on the line, and I want to highlight that this is not, I want to say it over and over again, this is not EPA policy. As a matter of fact, for the Hartford site, some of this is it might even be viewed as opinion. So, and we are covering the time-critical aspect of this. We will touch a little bit on some of the remedial and non-time-critical things, but really this was designed for OSCs to look at it from a time-critical perspective. We'll get into some, I've got listed there 5 to 10 vapor intrusion sites. With all the folks that normally put on the four-hour course here, we're probably closer to 10 to 15 vapor intrusion sites and growing. Like Steve mentioned, we put this together last year or earlier this year for in February, and the folks that work on this stuff continue to work on additional sites. So that's what we're drawing upon. We're going to present VOCs and petroleum site as our examples. And the VOCs is chlorinated solvents. And the petroleum or hydrocarbon site as our examples. And there are differences in how you should approach these things.
We're going to cover for you where the screening levels come from. OSCs generally go to ATSDR for screening levels. Might be a little bit different from the remedial folks who may go to the risk assessment group for screening levels, but we'll cover basically what they are. We'll discuss the sampling procedures and options. Sub-slab sampling, indoor-air sampling, and then lastly, we'll give you an overview of the two guidance documents that are out there, one from EPA and one from ITRC. Moving to slide number five, let's start off with what is vapor intrusion. The yellow box at the top is your textbook definition of what vapor intrusion is, the migration of volatile chemicals from the subsurface to overlying buildings. And I'm going to keep coming back to this photograph. This is almost really my conceptual site model of what happened at this site we're going to be talking about. But really what it is, and I've got a working definition at the bottom of what vapor intrusion is. This is my working definition. I really think this vapor intrusion is a symptom of the environmental community maybe ignoring contaminated groundwater sites, especially the ones in the cities. As recently as 10 years ago, we had the position that if you weren't drinking the contaminated groundwater, it wasn't a problem. Now, what we're understanding is we may be breathing the contaminated groundwater, and that's really what I believe vapor intrusion is, potentially breathing contaminated groundwater. Now, I've got 4 stars on the model here, and really what we need to do, and we're going to stress today, is you really need to connect in this order. As you evaluate a site, the groundwater, then the deep soil gas, which is the second star, and the 3rd star moving up would be the sub-slab evaluation, and then the 4th star would be the indoor air. And we're really going to stress over and over that sequential evaluation of a site in that order and really not try to short-circuit it. And we'll cover some of the issues that if you try to short-circuit it, what happens.
Okay, next slide number 6. We put this together in February, and this was a short snapshot of vapor intrusion across the country. These are just removal sites. This is not a current number. Don't look at your particular region or your part of the country and think, oh my, we only got 2 over here in the Northwest. The point of this slide is to say that vapor intrusion is across the country. Vapor intrusion issues are across the country. It doesn't matter where you are, it is across the country. And when we put this together again, this will be updated when we put it together next year. Next slide.
Coming off that map, you can see some regions had some higher numbers, some other ones had lower numbers. I just started tracking this bill working its way through Congress, which may really bring vapor intrusion to the national level, to EPA. And this was first, I just started tracking this in August of 2007, a bill called the Toxic Chemical Exposure Act. You can see some of the senators involved there, most likely due to a large vapor intrusion site in Endicott, New York, and Camp Lejeune in North Carolina is most likely the reason some of these senators are involved. But really what it was getting into was it was going to bring vapor intrusion and force the issue, force EPA to take some action. Next slide, which would be slide 8. This was a year later, July 2008. You could see this bill moving its way through a Senate subcommittee. So really haven't heard anything new since then, but you can see what it does. It's really calling EPA to attention here on the vapor intrusion issue. Okay, slide number 9, agenda. We're going to move right into a VOC case study in Ohio. slide 10. I'm going to cover this case study. I'm going to really be straightforward on some of the lessons learned. I'm going to cover some of the sampling procedures, screening levels that we applied, and mitigation options that we had at the site. Slide number 11. As an introduction to this, this bear site that I'm going to cover was really about the fourth vapor intrusion site that we had here in southwest Ohio. The Ohio EPA has been very aggressive in putting these kinds of sites together, doing a lot of the upfront work, which I'll cover, and then referring them to EPA. The first one was in 2006, the Springfield Street site. We ended up sampling 9 houses, installing 9 mitigation systems, and actually finding the source, which is a TCE spill in a neighborhood, and removing the source. So we were very fortunate to get to the source, and that's if you can get to that, that's great. The second one, moving clockwise, top right picture was the Troy VOC site in Troy, Ohio. Ended up sampling 80 locations, 16 residential locations were mitigated, and an elementary school, which you see in the picture. Bottom right is the bear site, which I'll discuss here coming up in a couple of minutes. Over 350 locations sampled, and an elementary school was mitigated, as well as over 200 houses. And then the last one, bottom left, is the Delphi site, which we sampled over 30 more houses. Now, what these all had in common, and I have it in red in the middle, is these were all the same, what we call the Great Miami Aquifer, sand and gravel, shallow aquifer, less than 25-foot depth to the groundwater from below these houses. These sites all had VOC groundwater contamination above 200 parts per billion in the groundwater, and they all had residential areas above them. So that's a couple of the common denominators that you had coming into these four sites. Next slide, which would be slide number 12. I put 7 characteristics together of these vapor intrusion sites that we're seeing in southwest Ohio. The map on the left is the bear site, which I'll cover. It's a former Chrysler plant, and depicted in yellow and blue is the plume. This site, once again, shallow groundwater contamination less than 25 feet, sand and gravel aquifer. We had VOC groundwater contamination above 200 parts per billion, and that was a real critical level. I'll cover that. That seemed to be the tipping point. Above 200 parts per billion in the groundwater was enough to cause a vapor intrusion problem in the houses. We have a lot of residential areas above the groundwater plume. In fact, what I call this is the old side of Dayton. This was really back in World War II era. This is the way they built factories. They built a factory and surrounded the factory with neighborhoods, and that's where the workers came from. Now, that's what's causing us problems now, because we have a spill at a factory, and the houses are right there next to the facility. And then the last characteristic, which is probably the biggest variable that I see at this site, we'll cover many variables. It's the basement type, which creates the biggest variable. Some are concrete basements, some are stone blocks, some are crawl spaces. So these are the 7 characteristics that we've seen at this site. Next slide, which is slide number 13, just an introduction to the site contaminant. Here at this site, it's TCE, trichloroethylene. We really partnered together with ATSDR and the Ohio Department of Health to try to educate the public on what the chemical is and develop screening levels. But once again, TCE is a man-made chemical, colorless liquid, excellent cleaner and degreaser. It's volatile, which means it's going to evaporate into the air. And once again, the health agencies, ATSDR, have established screening levels for this chemical.
Just a reminder to keep your phone lines on mute. Please hit #6 to mute your lines. Thank you.
Thanks, Jean. I'm on slide number 14. I just mentioned screening levels. Okay, so this is the first time we're going to be talking about screening levels. Region 5 in the removal program, the on-scene coordinators really gravitate towards ATSDR and the state health agency, in this case, Ohio Department of Health, to establish screening levels. In this case, at the Bear site, the health agency has established the screening level for indoor air of 0.4 parts per billion volume. And what that meant is if we saw levels above 0.4 parts per billion, they were recommending mitigation. Now, based on that, and an attenuation factor of 10, a subslab screening level was established for TCE of 4. And I'll cover what attenuation factors are later on, but that's just the relationship indoor air to subslab. Now, if the subslab screening level was exceeded with our sampling, all that told us to do was to go to the indoor air. If the indoor air was exceeded, it told us to mitigate. Okay, so these are the residential numbers. They also apply to schools. In Ohio, the residential numbers are applied to schools as well. There are separate screening levels for commercial locations. And in this case, based on folks being in a commercial facility less of the day, those levels are a little bit higher. So for this case, subslab for a commercial facility was 17 and 1.7 for indoor air. So just a note that you have commercial values, screening allowed values, and residential. Next slide is slide number 15. Just some background information on the site. In 2002, and I've got about 8 bullets here. A couple of these, 3 of these that I have stars next to, should really, they really rose a, put a red flag up for me. Number one, in 2002, Daimler Chrysler, who was the owner of this facility, from World War II up until about 2001, published a human health risk evaluation. Responsible party doing a health risk evaluation, presenting that to the Ohio EPA was really a red flag for me. But what it said in this 2002 report was TCE spilled at this facility in the bottom right corner of the yellow map on the right, the southeast corner of the TCE spill in the mid-1970s. Also identified in this 2002 report was a note that Chrysler initiated a groundwater pump and treat system in 2005. It's the jury's still out on what that was, what they were doing there, but I tend to believe, and the RPM assigned to the site now tends to believe that their pump and treat system was probably worsening the problem and spreading the contamination off site. Also noted here was in 2001, the Bayer facility, which is a German car company, car manufacturing subcontractor, bought the facility from Daimler Chrysler in 2001. Also in this risk evaluation report in 2002, it noted that TCE and PCE were the real drivers at the site. And also, here's my next red flag. It said that the residential indoor air inhalation risks are marginal. This was based on what's called the Johnson-Edgar model. Once again, the PRPs were running the model, and they did not take any subslab or indoor air results to back that model up. So this is what we had in 2002. This is what was presented to the Ohio EPA. The next slide is slide 16. Also, as we got into 2003, some off-site groundwater sampling was done. You can see at the base of the arrow in the yellow is roughly where the spill location was. And the groundwater moved in the southwest direction, and you can see the residential area immediately south of the facility, south of Leo Street. There was a group of about 20 houses directly south of the facility. Next slide is number 17, looking at some groundwater numbers that were presented to Ohio EPA in 2003. What's shaded here to the southwest is a contour line or groundwater results showing 5 parts per billion, which is the MCL, the drinking water number. That really doesn't apply to vapor intrusion. I've come up with a number here in this geology that when I'm looking at vapor intrusion, I actually want to circle a tighter contour line of 200 parts per billion. In this geology, what we're going to find out here is 200 parts per billion in the groundwater is the tipping point to cause a vapor intrusion problem. But what you see on this map on page 17 is at the southwest corner of the facility, a little hard to see, but that's the source area. groundwater was 20,000 parts per billion inside the facility fence. Next slide is slide 18. I'm going to keep coming back to this. This is my conceptual site model. What you'll see here is on the left side in the yellow, we've had the TCE chemical spill. I've added a box at the bottom there in yellow. We know we have groundwater contamination, TCE at 20,000 parts per billion at the source. And we're going to track this across. We're going to connect dots. We're going to connect groundwater to soil gas, sub-slab to indoor air. Next slide is slide number 19. This was groundwater data presented to the Ohio EPA in 2006. Looking a little bit closer south of the facility, these are residential, these are groundwater monitoring results in the residential area. You'll see numbers here ranging from 3,800 parts per billion for TCE to 16,000. Once again, this is groundwater at about an 18-foot depth below the houses. Once again, I'm comparing this. They're well above that theory that anything above 200 parts per billion in the groundwater is going to cause a problem. So this was presented to the Ohio EPA from Chrysler in 2006. Next slide is number 20. Back to the conceptual site model. Now we know that it's 20,000 parts per billion at the source. We know the groundwater's migrated to the south, southwest, and we've got about 16,000 parts per billion below the neighborhood. Okay, next slide is 21. At this point was October of 2006. The Ohio EPA in the left-hand picture is taking some groundwater samples. Actually, this is a vapor probe sample using a geoprobe. They've sampled seven locations. The geoprobe was put about approximately 15 feet down into the ground, and this is measuring the vapor above the groundwater. And you can see the results on the right. They had up to 160,000 parts per billion volume of TCE migrating off the groundwater below the houses. Once again, this is about a 15, 16-foot depth. Next slide is 22, back to our model. Now we know that it's migrated from the facility, the groundwater below the neighborhood. Now we've got soil gas. We call this deep soil gas, roughly about 15 foot deep. That's 160,000 parts per billion volume. Next slide is number 23. This is November 6th of 2006. The Ohio EPA requested EPA assistance. They noted the first two dots in our connect the dot paradigm here of the groundwater. The deep soil gas showed TCE with their sampling. They asked us to evaluate the site for potential vapor intrusion. The next slide is 24. Slide number 24, our first step was looking at this model, was to evaluate whether it was impacting the houses. And we do that, and instead of jumping directly into the house, we're going to go to what's called a sub-slab sample. And once again, back to our screening levels, ATSDR has advised us anything above 4 parts per billion volume would trigger the need to go indoor air. Next slide is 25. Just a note for the EPA folks, you want to execute a access form. You want to have the owner's permission before you go into a house. So this is just a example of the access form that we use. On the right, the owner signs giving EPA permission to be on the property. I've circled in red is the first attempt to capture some specific characteristics of the house, what kind of basement it is, concrete floor, dirt floor, and notes about the HVAC system. So right up front, you want to ask the owner permission and let them know after the sampling is completed, that you'll meet with them and just discuss the results. Okay, slide 26 is the sub-slab sampling procedure. We'll cover this in the sampling module later on with a little bit more detail, but what it is in the bottom right picture, this is a quarter-inch stainless steel tube that's drilled through the slab, and you want to get it down below the slab into the sanding or the gravel underlying the slab. And it's cemented into place. You can see on the left-hand picture, the probe is cemented into place. The tubing's connected to a Suma canister. We'll cover this later on as well. That's your sample canister that's under a vacuum. And we generally run a 24-hour sample. Now, what this is showing you is the amount of vapors, volatile organics, in this case TCE, that's accumulated below the house. That's called a sub-slab sample. Next slide is slide 27. We zeroed in on the first 8 houses south of the Leo Street, south of the Bear facility. And our subslab screening level was at the bottom. It's 4 parts per billion volume. And the first 8 houses came back well above that. All were above the screening level. So that told us we had this chemical accumulating at very high levels below the houses. Next slide is slide 28, back to our conceptual site model. Now we know the subslab levels for TCE are at 62,000 parts per billion volume. What we now know is it's accumulated below the house. The next step, slide 29, is indoor air sampling. There's a picture at the top right of an indoor air sample, assume a canister in the breathing zone in a basement. Once again, we're going to evaluate these samples against the ATSDR indoor air screening level, which in this case is 0.4 parts per billion volume. Anything above that level, they're going to recommend mitigation. Next slide is slide 30. Just a note before you go in, if you're investigating vapor intrusion at levels that you're dealing with here in the low part per billion range, you have to consider any indoor air interferences, and we'll cover this with some other slides later. But we use a checklist, which is on the right. You want to evaluate if the property owner is what kind of house it is here, for example. But you also want to start to screen for chemicals in the house, dry cleaning products, gas cans, paint cans, things like that. And what we do, not only to fill out the checklist and ask them verbally, we will use a couple different methods to screen the house with either a mobile laboratory, which is the TAGA, Toxic Atmosphere Gas Analyzer. We'll show you that later on. That's an EPA mobile laboratory. Or we use handheld equipment like the PPB ray to identify any of these indoor air sources. You want to remove those kind of items before you get into indoor air sampling. Paint cans, gas cans, dry cleaning. You want to remove that. That'll cause you interferences. Next slide here is slide 31. We went back to these 8 houses that had the subslab levels exceeded and went to indoor air sampling. All 8 houses, you can see, compared to the ATSDR indoor air screening level, they were all above 0.4 parts per million volume. You'll note a couple of these are actually above 100. The 0.4 number, we'll get into this in screening levels in a little bit, but there's 2 levels of screening levels here. There's the short term and the long term. The long term is 0.4, which they're going to require mitigation. If it's above the short term level, which is 100 in this case, they really want that house mitigated. The health agencies, they want that exposure terminated as soon as possible. So you're either in a temporary relocation situation or mitigate within days. And we did have several of those here. These houses were very high. We had levels up over 600 times the indoor air screening level. Next slide was slide 32. Really what this is showing you, back to the conceptual site model, you've connected the dots, the groundwater, the deep soil gas, the subslab, the indoor air. What the health agencies call this is a completed exposure pathway. We have vapor intrusion occurring at this site. Slide 33, we entered negotiations with the responsible party here in December of 2006. They came in, as they did, they were using basically a 4-year-old model situation to say there wasn't a problem. We had fresh data from 2006 saying we had a completed exposure pathway. So you can see real data trumps a model. Any day. They were also indicating their pump and treat system for the groundwater was controlling the situation, and had the position that this was probably a very localized problem. My analogy to them, I pretty much summed up the groundwater by saying if your facility is a barn, have you controlled the cows from leaving the barn? And they said, yes, there's no cows leaving the barn. We're controlling the groundwater. We're actually pulling the groundwater back. And what we'll find out later is I think the cows actually were still leaving the barn, actually are still leaving the barn to this day. Their pump and treat system may have been pushing this off-site. So we negotiated a consent agreement with the PRP here, divided it into two phases. Phase one, you'll see in the picture on the right, the purple locations are about 20 locations that we felt were time critical. So that was phase one, to quickly get in and investigate and mitigate as soon as possible. And phase two was to basically chase this vapor intrusion problem to the south following the groundwater flow. And you'll see that we had some discrepancies down the road about how far the plume went. Slide number 34. Beginning of the project, we had an order signed. We were working with a responsible party. For vapor intrusion, it is critical to conduct community relations, public meetings. What you're trying to do is to get into residential situations, residential houses, ask for permission to sample. If you don't get permission, you pretty much are going to be left with a data gap at your site. Now, the problem here is vapor intrusion is so new, most folks really need to be educated on the whole situation. It's like teaching a new language, and it's like teaching folks that, all right, breathing contaminated groundwater may be taking place at your house. A lot of folks don't realize that. They think that if you're not drinking the problem, you're not being exposed. So you can see some pictures here of our public meeting, working with our community involvement coordinators, working with the health agencies to go over the health issues in a public meeting and outreach situation. Slide number 35 are fact sheets that ATSDR and the Ohio Department of Health have put together. These are very good to hand out to the public. The one on the left is one specifically for TCE. The one in the middle is for vapor intrusion. Very good overview, written in language that most folks can understand. And the one on the right is the exposure to toxic chemicals. We'll show you where you can access these. We post these on a website if you need to use these. Slide number 36 is another way that we reach out as OSCs to the community is we have dedicated website set up, which we post this information so folks can see reports, pictures, fact sheets, links to news articles. Once again, this is just another outreach tool that we use. Slide number 37, cartoon drawing that we use to try to educate the public when we start to talk about mitigation. This is a drawing of what we call a sub-slab depressurization system, or SSDS for short, very similar to a radon mitigation system in which we're providing a path of least resistance. Instead of letting those vapors come up through the basement floor, we're going to route those into one or two extraction points through an exhaust fan and above the roof. A couple lessons learned here, and I'll go into this in a couple minutes here at the bear site. You really want to document that you have that whole basement floor under a vacuum, and we do some vacuum tests. You don't want to be exhausting one side and not the other, because it will find cracks in the floor and enter that house if you don't have that whole basement covered with a vacuum. The other secret here that we learned is you want to achieve this with the least amount of vacuum as possible. You don't want to turn this into a soil vapor extraction system. You don't want to be pulling these vapors to the house, because the makeup air when you do this comes from somewhere, and the makeup air could be coming off the groundwater plume, and you don't want to do that. So I'll show you here in a couple slides the kind of vacuum levels you want to be applying here. Once again, the least amount of vacuum. Slide number 38, this is the subcontractor installing an extraction point for the SSDS. We found it, based on the basement type, it's either one or two extraction points to achieve that radius of influence across the basement floor. Slide number 39, view from the outside. The picture on the left is the exhaust fan. And on the right, you can see it's routed exhaust above the roof line. Ohio code says that these systems must be exhausted above the highest window in the house. Slide number 40, costs. You can see here our average cost was $1,500. We had some systems that were going in, easy installs for $1,000. Some of them were $3,000 or $4,000 based on the number of extraction points and the size of the slab. There's an electrical switch you can see on the left here. That's usually locked in the on position after installation. Provide that key to the owner. And also the electric cost, it should be noted. Our engineers tell us that this has the same electric draw as a 75-watt light bulb, which is pretty much equal to about $75 a year. If the owner agrees to pay those costs, we pretty much have, at this site, installed this system for them. Slide 41. This was our big lesson learned about halfway through the project. When we installed these SSDS systems, we wanted to go in and document a radius of influence before we actually, our installer, left the house. So with the picture on the right, you can see one of our technicians taking a vacuum reading. That's a digital manometer that he's using. And we're going to go to a worst case in the basement away from the extraction points. And you can see here there's a measurable vacuum. And that's what you're looking for. If you get a measurable vacuum between your extraction points, you're going to guarantee success when you come back and do follow-up air sampling. And keep in mind, in this case, we went back at 30 and 90 days. We call that long-term sampling to prove the systems were working. Actually, we're up above a year on some of these locations to prove that they are working long-term. But once again, lesson learned. Apply that vacuum all across the basement floor. Slide 42, crawl spaces. This is a situation which is about 2 feet high, dirt, and you can see a plastic liner put down. You'll see a little rise between the pillars there. That's the extraction pipe that's laying underneath the liner. So the liner provides the membrane. So that's just an application for a crawl space. Slide 43, we had situations where we had dirt floor basements. And you can see the picture up on the right inset there. If we would have laid that plastic liner in a basement here, that folks were walking across, that would have quickly ripped up. So I tried another test case here to see what other options we would have. Next slide, which is 44. Picture on the left is a geotextile membrane, which is about a quarter inch thick, which is designed to give you some airflow. And you can see the pictures on the right. We basically installed a concrete floor to create that impermeable barrier. We had the liner underneath. Next slide, 45, you can see the finished concrete floor. Out of all the systems we installed, about 210 systems, this is the one that provided the highest radius of influence. That geotextile worked excellent. And what it was it was moving air better than the gravel moved there below an already installed floor. So this was a good lesson learned. This system does work. Slide 46, the picture on the left, this is what a finished SSDS looks like. This is the manometer that's installed. You can see the U-tube. It's a little hard to read there, but it's reading between 1 and 2 inches of vacuum. And that's about as high as you want to go. Anything more than that at this site, we were pulling too much vacuum and actually was raising the levels below the house instead of lowering them. And on the right, you can see the header pipe. That's fed into a manifold and out to the fan. But once again, in this case, 1 to 2 inches of vacuum gave us enough of a radius of influence. Slide 47, this is what we call performance sampling. You want to go back into the house, combination of sub-slab and indoor air sampling, provide that data back to ATSDR, for example, to prove your systems are working. We've blown this out to and done some houses at 180 days and up to a year. We're actually doing this on an annual basis now, long-term, to prove these systems are working. slide 48. Slide 48 shows what we call the vapor abatement system manual. I tell the homeowners up front that when we explain their sample results that they have a problem in the house, but we're going to work to mitigate that. And I want to give them enough documentation that if they sell the house in the future, they can prove that that's been taken care of. And that's because in Ohio we have a disclosure real estate law that you need to disclose this during a real estate transaction. So what this binder is, it wraps everything up for them after the installation. You can see in the red, might be hard to read there, but on the right in the red is the seven things in this binder that we give them. All the access agreements, the pre and the post sample results, pictures of their system, warranty information. The fans are usually under warranty for 5 years. So all that's rolled into a binder, and that gives them good documentation after. Okay. Next slide is slide 49. We'll also cover this in the groundwater module coming up, but this is just a groundwater contour model. We ended up at this point with Chrysler working with us in a argument about the groundwater flow. Basically, our models, as you can see here in red, the contour lines flare out. I'll call that a bell, shaped like a bell. And they had the opposite theory, which really impacted the amount of neighborhoods that were going to be mitigated. So you can see in yellow the one 200 part per billion contour line shown here. Next slide. Slide 50, once again in blue, Chrysler was taking the position that the groundwater contamination was converging, and that was shown here in blue, and you can see if it was actually flaring out like we thought it was, the two neighborhoods with the two question marks were potentially being impacted. So we had a dispute here under the order and ended up working two simultaneous projects here. Slide 51. Chrysler wanted to box this in and pretty much draw a line around it and say that no further contamination is leaving the boxed area. Really what they didn't know at the time, while they were working in the yellow box, we were taking samples outside of the box. And you'll see the blue sample locations are sub-slab samples that were less than the screening levels. And then to the south of the box, North Kiowee Street really became the battle zone, if you will. We started finding locations outside of where they thought their plume was going, which opened up a whole new neighborhood at the bottom of the map here. And what the three clusters together in red, just to the right of North Kiowee Street, that turned out to be an elementary school. And that's what the picture is on the right. This was the day the school was shut down. We received results about 3 days before the school was opening up in August. The school got shut down right away. So this opened up for us a whole new neighborhood to the south, which Chrysler did not want to move into. Slide 52. What we see here, looking at the groundwater results from 2003 to 2007, we'll see monitoring well number 38 to south of the facility. You can see that jumped up from just in those 4 years, this is levels of TCE in the groundwater, jumped up from the 600 part per billion range to 5,600. You can see, back to my barn analogy, the cows were still leaving the barn. The area just south of the facility was getting very, very high levels of TCE. And then at the bottom, you can see monitoring well 6 here jump up from 200 to 720. So the leading edge was horizontally, it was moving as well. So this really opened up this whole new neighborhood to the south, which they did not want to go into. Slide 53 summarizes a two-year removal action. Chrysler worked in the blue area. Anything shaded in red is a location that was mitigated. Those big green locations in the middle of the blue area are industrial, and they carry actually much higher screening levels and even commercial. So there was levels there, but they were just not meeting the industrial levels. The blue area was Chrysler. The yellow area, EPA stepped in and did a fund lead removal action. All told, we sampled together in the blue and the yellow almost 400 locations. 210 of these locations required mitigation. We actually had to install an SVE system, which I'll discuss here in a minute. We wrapped up our fund lead removal action in November of last year, and since then the site has been listed on the NPL, so we have a remedial investigation taking place right now. Next slide is 54. What I've done here is taken all the locations that required mitigation and overlaid the groundwater, 200 part per billion groundwater line or contour line here, and you can see it matched up pretty well. Once again, this is just a contour model where there's not a well out there. It kind of draws a line, but you can see it matched up pretty well here. That 200 parts per billion in this sand and gravel aquifer was a pretty good indicator where we were going to find a vapor intrusion problem. Next slide is 55. Back up to those first eight houses that started the project. We call that ground zero. We had problems, or Chrysler had problems, mitigating these first eight houses. Those SSDSs were just getting overwhelmed. They lowered the levels for TCE in the house, but just not to the screening levels. Slide 56 shows those first eight houses again. By this point, they had the SSDSs in the houses. They just were not lowering them enough. Slide 57 is just a blow-up of those, of that one square block area. What was installed here was a soil vapor extraction system. The 11 dots or 11 vertical probes that were installed in the yards. Basically, this whole square block was under vacuum. It was routed into a blower. Next slide is 58. You can see the blower on the left. It's in the shed there with the two carbon canisters that are treating the discharge. And the picture on the right, all the horizontal piping connecting the 11 extraction points are below the asphalt paving here. This was highly successful. This in combination with the in-house systems mitigated these houses very quickly. Next slide is 59. Just looking at some of the numbers here, this was probably an extreme site for a VOC site. Our highest indoor air level was over 1,100 times the indoor air screening level. Our highest subslab was over 1,600 times the screening level. The third bullet down there, just a note on access. Access is critical. We had probably at least 10 attempts to get in houses, either through public meetings or knocking on doors or mass mailers, and still only got to about 75% of the population out there. Out of those ones we did get to, 51% of those exceeded the indoor air screening level. So we had a very high ratio of houses that were sampled required the systems. We now know we have a moving TCE plume. And just at the bottom, you can see some of the numbers out of the ones that we mitigated. The houses requiring mitigation averaged 40 times the indoor air screening level or 93 times the subslab level. So some pretty high numbers here. Next slide, slide 60. For the EPA folks and that are out there, just a note here, we take action based on language in the National Contingency Plan. Or NCP. The NCP mentions actual versus potential threats. Region 5 in 2005 was taking action for vapor intrusion on a potential threat. And that means, you can see the bottom red box here, we interpret a potential threat as a subslab exceedance. Below the house, it's potentially a problem. We've changed that now in Region 5 that you really have to have that completed exposure pathway. Indoor air exceeded or an actual threat to take an action. So just a note here on actual versus potential threat. Slide 61. As a project manager, I've kind of noted here three possibilities when you evaluate a site. On one end of the spectrum, number one, your subslab level when you take samples is not going to show any exceedance. That one quickly drops out as they know for their action. You don't have a completed pathway. On the other end of the spectrum, like some of these bare site locations, the sub-slab level is very high, indoor air is very high, easy decision, completed pathway, mitigated. So one end of the spectrum to the other. The problem one comes in here is number three, and this is what I call a split decision. You've got elevated levels in the sub-slab above the screening level, but it hasn't crossed the threshold into the house. What do you do? Health agencies and some of the guidance may recommend additional monitoring from season to season. We see changes with groundwater levels going up and down or houses being buttoned up for winter. Keep in mind, some of this sampling costs up to $1,000 per sampling round. You can quickly exceed the cost of mitigation here. So as a project manager, you're going to have some pretty tough decisions if you have this third scenario. So just a heads up on that one. Next slide is slide number 62. We had simultaneous responsible party removal action going on at this site and EPA removal action. I was trying to mitigate as many locations as possible to protect public health. The responsible party had a little bit different viewpoint on that, and I realized after the fact what the cause was, and here it is. This is a website for the class action lawsuit. When a responsible party at a site mitigates a location based on a completed exposure pathway, they are in many ways admitting that they exposed somebody. So you can see they're getting set up for a lawsuit situation. So just different angles here, and you can see that you can take a look at that website if you have any interest in that. Next slide is back to the agenda. Health issues, slide 63. Once again, in our four-hour course, this is taught by ATSDR. Kevin and I are going to cover this in a condensed module. Okay, slide 64. Once again, ATSDR and your state health agencies, they're going to try to establish or should establish up front decision levels, screening levels, actions up front. You're really going to partner with the state health departments here, so that's where they're coming from. You're going to want good communication between your health agencies to let them have any input on maybe what seasons you're taking samples in for indoor air, any evaluation of preferential pathways, consideration of ambient air, indoor air issues. And once again, either ATSDR or your risk assessment folks are going to apply that attenuation factor. I'll cover that a little bit more coming up in some slides in a later module. And then keep in mind, when you reach out for your screening levels to the health agencies or your risk assessment folks, you're most likely going to have, I think 70% of the cases, you're going to have different residential and commercial values being applied. Slide 65, the relationship of health issues to the decision levels or the screening levels. Three of them play out here. I discussed some of these in the bare site. You've got the short-term ones, your acute health effects. They're going to apply a short-term screening level. And we had three of those right up front at those houses that were very, very high. They exceeded the short-term levels. The long-term levels, the chronic health effects, long-term screening levels will apply. At the bare site, that was the 0.4 number for indoor air. And then Kevin's going to cover at the Hartford site this fire and explosion health issue situation, which will apply immediate levels. Next slide is 66. So once again, you can see the screening levels playing out here. On the left, these first eight houses that we had for indoor air, you can see anything above 0.4 was above the long-term level requiring mitigation. And then those three that are above 100 parts per billion were above the short-term level requiring immediate mitigation. Slide 67, you can just see this in a table format for TCE. ATSDR is identified here in the second column, the 100 parts per billion short-term level. the sub-slab criteria in the third column, and in the indoor air to the right. Slide 68 is just some resources coming from ATSDR. Their toxic substances portal is noted there. That's where their tox facts are coming from, tox guide, public health statements. In Ohio, we work very closely with the Ohio Department of Health at these sites, and they partner with ATSDR, so they're a great resource. And then once again, the EPA IRIS system. Kevin, over to you.
Okay, slide 69. That's a picture in Hartford, Illinois. That is the outside of with a sub-slab depressurization system. Just take note on that. I'm going to cover that a little bit more in the future. But look at the size of that thing versus the sub-slab depressurization picture that Steve showed you as part of the bear site. Next slide, number 70. We're still covering some health issues here. And again, ATSDR covers this stuff, so we pulled some specific slides out. The red arrow are pointing to some numbers or some chemicals associated with hydrocarbons, isopentane and butane. And then up at the top, it's no arrow but hexane. These are not health-based numbers. The typical hydrocarbons, petroleum, you get the BTEX, and you can see the BTEX numbers on the table here. But ATSDR and your health professionals, state health professionals, and EPA health professionals can also provide you non-health-based numbers. So next slide, 71. Some of these health-based numbers are good. We use them, at least at the Hartford site, as good indicator chemicals. There might be a reason why the BTEX numbers are low, and maybe the non-health-based numbers still can be an indicator chemical or an indicator that vapor intrusion is still occurring. As well, then, the last bullet here is some of the immediate health effects from fire explosion, oxygen depletion. So when looking at a hydrocarbon site, or in many sites, especially if you don't know all of your chemicals of concern, coming up with some indicator chemicals can also be an indication that vapor intrusion is occurring. Number 72. Just looking at the isopentane, here's the example of that, a sub-slab sample with a comparison value of 1,150, and then we got a reading of 4,200,000. Well, if you look at the benzene up there, you see that's that's a qualified number at 26,000. Again, it's an indication here that we had vapor intrusion going on in this particular location, and the benzene number was a qualified number. So just consider non-health-based numbers as well. Next slide here. This is an old newspaper article for Hartford, just the town's on a time bomb. Next slide is 74. Some safety issues with the hydrocarbons again. Explosion, fire hazard, asphyxiation. With these types of instances, it's more of an urgent public health hazard. So you come up with contingency plans. The fire department's involved. If you got vapor intrusion around hydrocarbon sites, relocation has occurred several times within Hartford, Illinois. Next slide. Now these are, we got to stress this over and over again. Most of us project managers are not health professionals. Bringing in that health professional, and whomever that is, as Steve indicated, we use, as OSCs, at least in Region 5, we like to use ATSDR. However, the other programs have their own health professionals, and the locals and the state play an important role. And here are some of the six bullets here that they actually provide for you. They develop these health-based screening levels. And Steve will cover this in a little while, but they're not necessarily uniform across states. They'll help evaluate the sampling data from the health professional and the health-based perspective. They'll respond to citizens' health questions. They're, most of them are pretty good in a public meeting. They'll provide health care education. And then the last bullet here is that they'll support us during public meetings. Next slide. Now we're going to jump into some groundwater issues here. That was just a brief overview of health issues. We recognize that health issues with vapor intrusion is a large issue, big issue, and we just kind of touched upon it. So, Steve, slide 77 with some groundwater issues.
Okay, just a note that your site hydrogeology and your urban features are going to be a key to evaluating whether vapor intrusion is occurring or not. So, and once again, I did mention before, I think the biggest variable is the basement types. And you could see different sample results on the same block of a neighborhood just based on people having different basement types. So that's key in evaluating your site. Slide 78, a couple ways to evaluate groundwater issues, permanent wells. Provide a consistent data point, repeated data point for trend analysis, and there's a way to for groundwater monitoring to install equipment in there for that purpose. But once again, these wells need to be maintained. Slide 79, temporary wells. We showed you some pictures of geoprobe installation. Good grab point or vapor sample point as well with the temporary well. Good way to get a snapshot of the groundwater, and once again, can be used as a vapor plume monitoring point as well. Costs, last bullet, big cost savings with a temporary well situation. Slide 80, just a summary here. No site is the same. We did have some similarities in those four Dayton sites because we were all in the same sand and gravel aquifer, for example. But there is no boilerplate for these vapor intrusion sites. You need to take a look at that hydrogeology. We're going to keep coming back to that. You got to take a look at that. That's the key. That's the first a bullet when you actually connect the dots here. And then, once again, don't assume without adequate data. Data trumps a model any day. And you're going to hear us say that several different times today. Okay, slide 81. I showed this to you earlier, but there was this is the bare site. Our groundwater models, this is from ERT. They assembled this contour map for me. This was EPA's position that we had a TCE, a groundwater plume flaring out, and a responsible party basically saying it was going the other way. So the battle here at a vapor intrusion site all started with groundwater. Slide 82. Once again, I showed this to you previously. You can see by taking up the groundwater from 2003 to 2007, it was not only getting worse in the neighborhood at the source, but it was horizontally extending at the bottom here to a whole new neighborhood over a four-year period. So that was a good predictor back to that 200 part per billion level in the groundwater, a good predictor in this hydrogeology that where the vapor intrusion problem was going to occur. Slide 83, I showed this to you again. It turned out after the fact, after looking at 400 rounds of data, the houses in red required mitigation. Overlay that 200 part per billion groundwater contour on there. It was a great predictor in this situation of where the vapor intrusion problem was going to be located at. Okay, back to the agenda on slide 84. We've mainly covered up to this point the VOC example. Kevin's going to give you a hydrocarbon case study called the Hartford site.
Okay, jump to slide 85. There it is. Let's go to 86. The project description. The first bullet there, 10 plus million gallons of gasoline, diesel, unrefined products released from buried pipelines and from the surrounding refineries over a 40-year period. Very briefly, are responsible parties here, and I'm only going to just cover this once, are Shell, BP, Premcor, which was formerly known as Valero, Sinclair, and then we've got a fifth one called Apex Oil. So 10 million gallons, you know, that's kind of a ballpark figure. I've heard and seen estimates as high as 40 million gallons, and I've seen estimates as low as 3 million gallons. I don't think in this case it really much matters. The gist of it here is that we've got a lot of gasoline and diesel beneath this town. Second bullet, 211 homes located over a thick layer. I'll get into this a little bit more. We've gotten into 160 of these homes. Let me just backtrack just a slight bit here, because a lot of what Steve presented, whether it's sub-slab sampling in a basement, plume modeling, things like that, we of course did the exact same thing, similar things here. Some of the things that he did I'm going to point out as being different for a hydrocarbon site. And so I will constantly refer back to what Steve brought up as for a chlorinated solvent site. So let's see, second bullet there, we got into approximately 160 homes. So we have quite a few homes that we did not get into. One of the primary things that we were charged with was protecting the village of Hartford public water supply. We started this, the US EPA got involved in 2003. It is ongoing, and we've been messing around with this and dealing with the oil companies here since significantly since 2004. We got involved in late 2003, and 2004 onward, we've been addressing the vapor issues here and the gasoline issues. Last bullet, seasonal vapor intrusion. That was the case and still seems to be the case, but seasonal vapor intrusion usually is associated with elevated groundwater, and we're right next to the Mississippi River, so also elevated surface water, because they are directly connected. Next slide. Slide 87. One of these slides was a backdrop to a previous slide, but the way that I always like this slide, and I always point out on this thing, that if you can sustain a flame in your basement, on your basement wall, you have vapor intrusion. Kind of a little bit of a takeoff of a Jeff Foxworthy there. So, circa 1972, and take note of that basement, the construction. You see above the wall on the right picture there, where there's a brick and block? That is typical. That is typical in Hartford, and you also notice that in a lot of Steve's pictures, that the basement construction plays big into vapor intrusion. Next slide, 88. As we got involved with this and these oil companies started negotiations and working with these oil companies, we had a lot of field work to try to figure this thing out. We had multiple work plans. You can read them there. We had multiple pilot tests. And the first bullet under multiple pilot tests is interim measures. In early 2004, late 2003, the reason we got involved is because people were complaining about gasoline and diesel fumes in their homes, and they were being moved out, and they didn't know what to do, and the oil companies were trying to do what they could do, but they didn't have a coordinated approach to deal with this vapor intrusion at this particular town in 2003. So when we got involved, the US EPA got involved, we started working with interim measures, and I'll cover those here in a minute. Some of the other tests that we got into was, how are you going to remove the product, multi-phase extraction, you can read them there, SVE, which is the major thing that we're dealing with right now. We also looked at skimming and pump tests and looked at really cone and depression. Could you
could you sink a typical groundwater pump and treat system in a highly productive sand and gravel aquifer next to the Mississippi River? And would it work? Next slide, 89. I mentioned interim measures. We were having people that were had odor complaints. They were calling the fire department. Well, the program that we came up with was something that we labeled interim measures, and we brought we conducted something called a needs assessment. And so each structure, whether it was residential, whether it was a church, whether it was a business, and regardless of what the structure was, we conducted what was called a needs assessment. And we went into the home and we assessed the need or the likelihood of vapor intrusion, which included such similar things as what Steve mentioned, a list of questions for the homeowners. We would look at the integrity of the walls. We would do indoor air sampling as part of it. We would put in sub-slab monitoring ports, very similar in look to what Steve showed. We made available to everybody, at least early on, a sub-slab depressurization system and a vent fan. And then, of course, we had emergency response activities and contingency plans. And the contingency plans were, if people needed to be relocated, where were they going to go, what were they going to do, who was going to pay for it, how were they going to eat, all those types of things. Sub-slab depressurization system, and I'll get into this a little bit, we ended up only putting in three or four of them in Hartford, and there's a big difference on those. For a hydrocarbon site, as you saw in that one earlier picture, they're much larger. We turned up the vacuum on these things when we first put them in, and we were actually getting LEL levels out the stack. So it really wasn't working. You couldn't turn them down. You couldn't dial them down enough to where we felt that they were being effective. We also were looking at these sub-slab depressurization systems and thinking if we had to put in 150 of these across this town, all we were doing was transferring the contaminant from the ground into the air. There was no treatment on these blowers. The blowers had to be intrinsically safe. So we eventually just shied away from them from this hydrocarbon situation. And rather than the sub-slab depressurization system on a home-by-home basis, we went with a site-wide soil vapor extraction. And I'll get into that a little bit more. Next slide, number 90. Just a schematic here showing the Mississippi River on the left, the town of Hartford, immediately next door to it. We've got the main fan, that's the big, the main portion that is showing, the dotted line goes right through the main fan. And then we've got some fingers of some, various other less permeable materials, above the main fan. But the big thing here is that you can see the direction of groundwater, historically, the direction of groundwater has been toward the Mississippi River. We still have refineries in the area, and they have been pumping water, which has altered the groundwater flow away from the river for a good portion of the year. Next slide is 91. When we got involved, we needed to get a handle on the size of the plume and where it was and under whose house was it under and under whose house wasn't it under. So one of the tools that the oil companies used was this ROST, which stands for Rapid Optical Screening Tool. It's very, it follows the geoprobe concept. And the thing that's really cool about it is that it gives you real-time monitoring. And so when the hole, the geoprobe-type hole is in the ground, they would drop this ROST down into the hole, and we would be able to read on the screen on the picture that's on the right. And the different colors here, and I can't read it from my slide, but the different colors here represent the different types of hydrocarbons. So the green may be gasoline, and the red may be diesel. I don't know, but it was very quick and very easy, and you can even do it in winter, as you can see in the left, to delineate the plume using this ROS investigation. And then we would also come back and do some additional field probe work and soil sampling and analysis to verify. Next slide is 92. So what this thing showed was that, and we produced all sorts of lots of pretty maps. The picture on the left is the highest concentration of the gasoline and diesel, and the picture on the right is the extent of it. So, and this is in the main stratum. So that's the highly productive sand and gravel that is right next to the Mississippi River. The next picture, slide 93. So we went a little, you figure out where the free product is. That's what the ROS is telling you, where the free product or more free product versus the vapor. We then took it and started looking at the vapor concentrations, and we did a vapor study. And we did the vapor study in order to design the SVE. And I mentioned about the needs assessments and going into all these homes. Well, you know, that's very time-consuming, very costly. So we started looking at the SVE from a shallow perspective, and how can we intercept the vapors coming from the deeper locations before they come in contact with the basements and the slabs of people's homes. So this picture on 93 just shows that there's slightly different variations between the deep vapor and the shallow vapor, and then this influenced where and how we would install the soil vapor extraction probes. Next slide is a little bit of a case study within a case study, and this is dealing with a particular home, 119 West Date. And the reason I bring this up is because 119 West Date is a particular home in town, and it really highlights and brings forth some variations on how vapor intrusion works. In 2004, first bullet there was a soil vapor extraction well that was located approximately 30 feet from this home. A needs assessment was conducted in July of 2004, and a mitigation package was installed. Now, the mitigation package following a needs assessment could be that the basement walls were sealed, the floor might be sealed, the various other potential avenues for vapor intrusion might have been sealed, being floor drains, lack of a trap in a floor drain, or maybe other utilities that enter into a home might be sealed. A vent fan was probably put in. Various things like that are what we call the mitigation package. Now, we're stopping short. We used to have the SSD test, but we stopped short of those after a while because they really weren't working for us. Subside monitoring ports began, and sampling began in June of 2006. And so from June of 2006 to February of 2007, they were low and unremarkable results. Next slide, 95. So in May of 2007, during routine quarterly subslab monitoring at this home, 119 West 8, suddenly we were seeing these isopentane numbers and hexane numbers, 17 million, 1,300,000. That was in subslab. The second bullet under there, they were also at 90% of LEL, and then in May 2nd, they were over range. So we knew something was happening. Next slide. Slide 96. You can see these numbers here. Here's our comparison value on the left for indoor air, and then here's the subslab comparison value. Next slide, 97. This was measured actually in the home, first floor and basement. Again, you notice we've got isopentane and hexane. You notice that I don't have benzene listed here. I don't remember the benzene numbers, but these numbers were extremely high, and it was telling us that vapor intrusion was occurring. Next slide, 98. Mabel Edwards, the resident of that home, she agreed to leave her home, stay with her daughter. By late May, now remember, this was all occurring in early May. By late May, the vapors in the home had subsided. So they were, the oil companies were doing regular sampling in the home. They were taking FID and Summa canisters readings in the home. I don't think it was daily, but it was three, four times a week, subslab levels as well. So all of a sudden, for no apparent reason that we could tell, the levels subsided. Next slide, 99. The oil companies agreed to do a mini investigation just associated with 119 West State, and they conducted some geoprobe borings. Showed that there was a relatively thin layer of a clay silt beneath the home, with more porous sand layers above and below. Also, they discovered that the groundwater levels rose 3.5 feet during April and May of 2007. The vapor data showed that pressure built up in the main sand, forcing the gases upward into the shallower zones closer to the home. So what was happening was, well, let me get to that in a minute. Let's go to the next slide, slide 100. This shows 119 West State is right in the middle. You can see that we have monitoring points, water, we've got vapor probes, we've got SVE probes around here. This portion of town is littered with holes in the ground. Next slide, 101. What we concluded at this site, in this situation, and why I'm really highlighting this, is that your geology and your weather can greatly affect whether or not you have vapor intrusion. On slide 101, we had rapidly rising groundwater levels. And during those spring months in 2007, it forced the hydrocarbons in the main sand through a relatively thin layer toward the home. It was almost like a piston effect. The Mississippi River rose, the groundwater levels rose, they rose rapidly, the vapors had nowhere to go, so they came up. Well, you know what, we had an SVE system in the area, but the upward migration of the vapors could not control or be controlled by the SVE system. Because there was positive pressure going on, and it overwhelmed the SVE system in the area. We had relatively thin clay layers directly beneath the home, and the SVE system couldn't keep up with the piston effect of the groundwater coming up so rapidly, and therefore the vapors entered into this particular home. And the interesting thing is that the homes on either side of 119 West State, they didn't have a vapor intrusion issue. It was very specific. Next slide, slide 102. This is showing, what happened was is that the SVE well that was 30 feet away got moved to directly in front of Mabel Edwards' home. And you can see in the bottom picture on the left that it was in the sidewalk and directly in front of her home. Next slide is 103. This is a picture of North Hartford, and all the green dots on there are SVE wells in North Hartford. They are in various strata throughout North Hartford, and as the groundwater levels rise, certain wells might be occluded and they're no longer used. As the groundwater level drops, certain wells that were occluded from water might be turned back on. I think at this point we have approximately 80 of the 102 wells. I think we have 102 SVE wells out there. Many of them are nested. Approximately 80 are operating right now, and that seems to be about average based upon groundwater levels. Next slide, 104. This again is showing the subslab depressurization system, and the big difference between a chlorinated solvent site, such as Steve mentioned, and the Hartford case is the size, the intrinsically safe, the money, the LELs, things of that nature. Next slide, 105. This is highlighting again these isopentane and hexane numbers can be really, really high. And then if you look to the left of those numbers, you see the benzene numbers. Those are high as well. But I just, I guess the point with the hydrocarbon site is, as the yellow indicates up there, sometimes you need to evaluate broader than just BTEX, because BTEX may not always tell you whether or not you have vapor intrusion occurring. All of those are subslabs. If you look at that 112 West Birch, it's subslab 1, 2, 3, and 4 in a basement. We're really not going to get into how many subslabs you put in a home, square feet. That is for another day. Next slide, 106. Steve hit on this a little bit, and I'm going to hit on it as well. It's kind of a little bit out of place here, but common indoor air chemical sources. We can't stress enough that you gotta, before you start taking indoor air and subslab samples, indoor air specifically, you really need to get all of those chemicals that are sitting underneath your sink, that are in your, if you've got a garage that's attached, that are in the garage, that are in your basement, your paint cans. This list right here is an amazing list of the types of chemicals on the left and what they're found in. And this stuff really, really can influence whether or not you believe you have vapor intrusion in your house or in a particular home. So, next slide, number 107. Sampling procedures. Again, this is put together by ERT, and we just got a couple of highlights on what those particular from their presentation. So next slide is 108. Some of the sampling procedures, I highlighted that ROST and geoprobes, and here's a picture of a geoprobe, these direct push probes. They don't create much of a disturbance. You can even drive these rigs up in yards if you can get access to do that. And you can do it without removing soil, and then you don't have any kind of soil disposal issue. Next slide, 109. We've got this in here. This is angle drilling as an alternate to sub slab. Let's say nobody would let you in your house, in their house. They don't want to be disturbed. They don't want they don't want you in the house and drill a hole through their slab of their basement. You can do angle drilling. This is not the preferred method. There's no question that this method will give you some information, but it won't necessarily give you all the good as good information. And one thing I'd like to highlight about the subslab sampling, we found in Hartford, especially with these older homes, we didn't necessarily have gravel beneath the slab. Some of these slabs in these basements were put directly on clay. So you might take a subslab, you might put in a subslab monitoring point and run into clay. Well, clay, as you all know, isn't going to be a good conductor for vapors. Just keep in mind that when you put in a subslab monitoring point, if you have clay, then you might have different issues. This may be an alternative if that's the case. But again, not a preferred alternative. Next slide, 110. This is just a picture that shows how close to a home you actually can get. It's right there next to the sidewalk in the house. So it's very close, and you can also see how literally disturbed, no broken sidewalks and things like that. Next slide. Steve, you're up.
Okay, thanks, Kevin. One of the other things, comparing the near slab versus the sub slab, is that these vapors may be reacting differently under the middle of the house than the edge. It almost creates a confined space situation that you may miss if you're near slab. So slide 111, we keep stressing this, but this stepwise approach in evaluating the groundwater to the deep vapors to the subslab to the indoor air, that's really, I believe, the way to do this step by step. Slide 112, this is a schematic of our subslab sampling port. On the toolbox that we're going to share with you here shortly, we've posted the environmental response team SOP for installing this. It's a quarter-inch stainless steel tube. You can see the schematic here. You want to get that down below the slab into the gravel below the slab. And then at the top, it's countersunk to make a flat connection fitting. So that's what the schematic looks like. Next slide is 113. One of our technicians installing a subslab sampling port. In this case, it's in a school. So you want to try to find an out-of-the-way area, if you can, but they all can't be in the corner. You want to try to get some towards the middle if you can. Next slide is 114. You can see it's countersunk level with the floor. It's cemented into place, and the procedures are going to call for let that set up for 24 hours. Before you sample it. Slide 115, you can see the connection on the left, the tubing being routed through the port. On the right, you can see connection to the subslab sample port to your SUMA canister, which is under vacuum, and you run that for 24 hours with the correct flow to get your reading. The other thing, Kevin mentioned some of these basements do not have gravel. You got to watch. Sometimes it'll start sucking in water. You don't want to be doing that as well. If you have water right below the slab, that causes a sample problem as well. 116. Here's your indoor air sample. I would just note here in the picture, you probably want to get this a little bit higher up into the breathing zone. Probably 2 to 4 feet above the floor is good for an indoor air sample. That's the SUMA canister. 117, ambient air sampling. It's good on days that you're collecting subslab or indoor air to take an ambient air sample for comparison as well. 118, Kevin mentioned this. I mentioned it during the bear site. You really have to watch the indoor air interferences. You've got consumer products, dry cleaning, gasoline cans, paint cans in the house. You really have to screen for those. They're going to provide interference for your indoor air sampling. So Once again, just heads up on that. Next slide, 119. This is one of the tools that we use. I mentioned earlier we use handheld instruments, PPB ray, for example, to screen a house. This is one of three mobile laboratories that the environmental response team of EPA utilizes, Trace Atmospheric Gas Analyzer, or TAGA unit. The mobile laboratory, next slide is 120. This is a different shot. Two ways that we've used this for vapor intrusion sites, either grabbing a Tedlar bag sample, sub-slab or indoor air, and then walking it outside to the TAGA unit, and they run it real time. Or the second option, which is real good for screening a house for indoor air interferences, they have a 200-foot hose that they can walk through the house, and the technician can sit at the screen outside in real time to see interferences. They can pick up those products in the house right away, so you can remove them. So this is a valuable tool. We've used this at several vapor intrusion sites in Region 5. Slide 121, you can see the gas chromatograph inside the TAGA unit. And there's a dedicated crew that works this. Slide 122, this is the kind of situations you could run into. This is a garage full of all kinds of indoor air interferences. So watch out for that. You don't want bad data. Okay, 123, slide 123, back to the agenda. I'm going to cover a couple slides here, what we call the vapor intrusion toolbox. Slide 124, you can go to this website. Actually, ERT has upgraded the website in the last 6 months. It's www.epaosc.org. Use ORG instead of net. I think either one should get you to it, though. / vapor intrusion. And we're going to share some documents that we've posted on here for use. This is a public website. Slide 125, you're going to find the course PowerPoints on there from our four-hour version of the course will be on this website. Those ODH fact sheets, which I showed you earlier, example letters of sending letters that we communicate to the public, example letters that you can utilize, example access forms. In a couple of minutes, we're going to cover the EPA 2002 vapor intrusion guidance that's posted on this website. The 2007 ITRC guidance is posted. And the ERT subslab sample SOP is on here as well. In addition, I've recently added the EPA online tool for the Johnson-Ettinger model. That link is posted on this website on the toolbox as well. Slide 126, back to the agenda. Kevin and I are going to cover briefly the two guidance documents that are out there. Slide 127. The document on the left has been around since 2002. It's EPA's Osworth guidance paper. And the one on the right that we'll cover is the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, which is made up of state-led groups from 46 states. That kind of supplements the 2002 guidance. That's the latest of what's out there, and we like that. Slide 128. Getting into the 2002 EPA guidance, if you're a new project manager with a vapor intrusion site, I would suggest reviewing both of these documents. This is where you're going to find some of these definitions and some of the issues that we've covered here. So 129 gives you an overview of the table of contents on what's in the 2002 guidance. I'm going to cover a couple highlights here in the next couple of slides. Slide 130. In the introduction, it's going to tell you right up front, this is a guidance document for vapor intrusion. It's not a regulation, and as of 2002, was presenting the latest technical and policy recommendations. And it's really a tool for the project manager to walk you through a process for you to evaluate whether you've got that completed exposure path, whether you've got vapor intrusion or not. Slide 131. You can see where some of these models have come from, these photos that we've used in this presentation, right out of the guidance. But there's a good explanation in Chapter 2 of what the textbook version of what vapor intrusion is, migration of the volatile chemicals from subsurface to the overlying buildings. That's where that definition comes from. Slide 132. You're going to see in here a three-tiered approach for evaluating a site. Tier one is what's called primary screening. What kind of characteristics do you have at the site that potentially could cause vapor intrusions? Do you have VOCs present in the soil? Do you have buildings that are occupied over a groundwater plume? Just kind of a initial screening situation for you to evaluate. That's called tier one. Next slide is 133, tier two. What evidence do you have out there? What data do you have available? Remember our four dots. Do you have any groundwater data available? Any soil gas, deep vapor data? Any subslab data? Any indoor air data that you can screen with? And then here's where it's noted, where the Johnson-Ettinger model is referenced, and this was originally put together as a model in 1991. It's being updated, but once again, it's a simplified assumptions that are put together on the EPA online tool with a series of drop-down menus where you put in your contaminant of concern and other site information, and it's going to be a predictive model. That's where that's discussed in Tier 2 in secondary screening. Slide 134 is getting into the field. Talks about site-specific assessment, subslab indoor air sampling, whether you have a completed pathway or not. And here's a note in the guidance document, once again, about the indoor air interferences. Just a heads up about fuels and paints in the house. So that's the three-tiered approach in the 2002 EPA password document. Slide 135 gets into attenuation factors in Appendix F. Now, what the attenuation factor is the relationship or the ratio of indoor air to subslab. So, for example, back to Ohio at the Bear site, ATSDR and Ohio Department of Health had an indoor air screening level of 0.4 parts per million volume. Based on a 1 to 10 attenuation factor, the subslab screening level is 4. And generally, going into a new site, right now, you're going to have a 1 to 10 attenuation factor. I can tell you, after looking at 400 rounds of data at the Bear site, if the indoor air screening level was 0.4 parts per volume, we probably could have gone to a 1 to a 100 attenuation factor. And what that means is, after looking at 400 rounds of data, I've concluded that it would take 40 parts per billion subslab to cause an indoor air problem of 0.4. But only after looking at 400 rounds of data could I make that conclusion. So, and this is being looked at in a national database, the whole attenuation factor situation. But generally, you'll probably start with a 1 to 10 ratio. Slide 136, Appendix H, talks about community involvement. We've talked about how to communicate to the public, websites, public meetings, mass mailers. We've had a range of success wrapping all three together at the site. And once again, kind of educating the public. It's almost like teaching a new language, explaining to folks that they may be breathing contaminated groundwater, which is what vapor intrusion is. So that's covered in Appendix H of the EPA guidance.
Okay, slide 137, the 2007 ITRC document. The first document by Osware was 2002, 5 years later, this document has come out. But as Steve indicated, both of these are good documents to read. I'm sure there are lots of other vapor intrusion documents out there as well. These are just two that we're highlighting. As he mentioned, it's a coalition of 46 environmental professionals from 46 states. Next slide, 136. It puts these good schematics out there to visualize what vapor intrusion is and how it might occur. And it also promotes the use of a conceptual site model. And I wholeheartedly agree with the conceptual site model. At the Hartford site, we had volumes and volumes of data. And until everything was kind of put into that site model, it was really, really hard to get your hands around it and what it really means. So please, if you have a large vapor intrusion site, a conceptual site model is really the way to go. Next slide, 139. The ITRC document gets into soil gas versus soil vapor. It's a good distinction. You can see in the yellow at the bottom of that slide, very simply put, soil gas. Gaseous elements between soil particles versus soil vapor gaseous elements in a structure. So this document gets into it a little bit and gives you some good background as to how to view this particular topic. Next slide, 140. Gets into preferential pathways. And again, in the yellow here, underground utilities and sewers. At the Hartford site again, our utilities and the utility corridors that run along streets have proven to be a mechanism for vapors to migrate and move. And then the utility corridors that move from the street into the home. I mentioned earlier the lack of a trap in a drain in a basement can be a means for vapors to enter into homes. And we found that repeatedly. All we'd do is put our FID probe right into that drain, and boom, the thing would go off the charts. Putting a trap in there alleviated that. So this document gets into preferential pathways and explains some of these things. Next slide. 141.
The ITRC document discusses screening levels. I've highlighted there with the red line that about 70% of the states that you're dealing with are going to have different residential and commercial numbers. And I discussed that. That's based on folks occupying a house for 20 hours a day and a commercial setting for 8 hours a day. So you're going to see some variation there. In Ohio, the Ohio Department of Health is making the recommendation that schools get applied to residential screening levels. Now, that may, in another state, may be different. So just heads up, state to state, schools may fall into a different category. And then just a note about standardizing screening levels. We're not at that point yet. If you work in multiple states, for example, last year I worked in Ohio, which had an indoor air screening level for TCE of 0.4 parts per billion volume. And up in Minnesota later, they elected or recommended a indoor air screening level for TCE of 0.5 parts per billion volume. So you can't carry these state to state yet. There's little differences. So just heads up for the folks that work in multiple states. Slide 142. I think I covered this previously. Mitigation, really as an investigator, it's your role to evaluate whether you have vapor intrusion occurring or not. And I've simplified it here in the yellow box of these three simple scenarios playing out. Nothing in the subslab or in the indoor air, no further action at one end of the spectrum. Second option is your screening levels are exceeded in the subslab and indoor air. Completed exposure pathway, move on to mitigation. And this split decision one, which is number three, where you've got it below the house but not in the indoor air, which throws you into a long-term monitoring situation or at least a seasonal monitoring situation, and then you have to evaluate whether you're actually exceeding the cost of mitigation at that point. So that's a tough decision as somebody that's investigating a site. That's all covered in 3.9 and 4 of the 2007 document. Chapter 4, I'm on slide 143. Real good spreadsheet here of mitigation options. They cover the technology on the left, the application challenges, and the cost on the right. You can see the subslab depressurization system, or SSDS as we call it. We used it at the Bear site, 95% success rate, really taking an off-the-shelf radon mitigation system with a little bit of customizing it with the radius of influence testing before we left the house, and it was highly successful, other than a couple houses that were right across the street from the facility that were just, the groundwater was just very high. Worked very well at the Bear site for SSDS. Kevin, you want to cover the Hartford site?
Yes, the at Hartford, the SSDS was not successful. They're too large. The vacuum caused more vapors, too many vapors, too much vapors, too much quantity of it to come toward the house. When we did crank it up, we were in essence just transferring untreated vapors from the subsurface into the air. We had LEL levels in our stack, and we couldn't really justify putting LEL levels in 160 homes. We opted not to go with it at the Hartford site. Steve?
Second line item there on the chart, submembrane depressurization. That's the plastic liner in the crawl space scenario where you can't apply your normal situation for an SSDS. We've done that at a number of locations at the Bear site, and it worked very well. Keep in mind, if it's in an area where people are going to walk, it's going to quickly rip up. So it really is applied to a crawl space scenario. The third line item there is the subslab pressurization using positive pressure. The responsible parties used this at the Bear site in a crawl space under the school, forcing air in. It did not work in this situation. I would conclude that just the engineering applied correctly for that. So, once again, Chapter 4 in the 2007 document lays these different mitigation options out. Slide 144, we've covered this. There's a good Chapter 4 on the SSDS. Once again, we were installing these at the Bear site, some of them for $1,000, some of them for $3,000 or $4,000 based on the square footage, and getting the radius of influence coverage, getting the whole basement floor under a vacuum, determine the price. Kevin, you want to cover the Hartford site again?
Yeah, you guys can read here in the yellow, $15,000 average to install. Depending on the condition of the basement, it was maybe a little higher, depending on how much junk was down there and one had to move around, it could be a little higher. And again, larger, as I mentioned earlier, at $15,000, very expensive. So as a project manager, those are costs should be taken into consideration.
And just a note here on slide 144, this SSDS, I call it a glorified Band-Aid. It stops the exposure to the resident in the house, and that fan's going to run, let's say, eight years. We've got an eight-year window there for the remedial program to initiate, get through a remedial investigation, and get to remedial action before this Band-Aid wears out. So once again, I really look at this at the Bear site as a Band-Aid, not a permanent solution. The permanent solution is cleaning the groundwater up. Slide 145, Appendix D. We shared the sampling procedures, the subslab sample procedures. I showed you where to find the ERT sample port. Installation SOP. Appendix D just covers that in detail. How to apply that, how to avoid utilities. Once again, you want to avoid if you've got a groundwater right below the slab, that's going to affect your sample port as well. That's Appendix D. Appendix D also on slide 146 covers the use of the SUMA canisters. Couple notes here. At the bear sites, we were under $300 for a canister for TO15 analysis, which is what we were using for VOCs. Another note is, keep in mind there's a finite number of these SUMA canisters in the country right now. If you get a big site, you may have to go to multiple sources, and your turnaround times could affect that. So just be aware. These are a great tool to use, but there's only so many of them out there right now. Kevin, slide 147.
I know we got a pretty good cross-section of people on the phone here, but this brownfields technology is also a good primer. I would say it's probably vapor intrusion, not 101, maybe 102. But I think the point of this is that vapor intrusion is across the programs. And if you're an EPA person or a state EPA person, whether it's within the Superfund program or the RCRA program, the brownfields program, vapor intrusion is here. And this particular document is also a good document to get you started. We're not going to go through it, though. Steve?
Next slide is actually, I believe this is our last slide, 148. Henry Schuber from EPA headquarters sent this to me last year, just as a roadmap of where EPA headquarters envisioned us moving in the vapor intrusion field. The three red arrows, number one, continued use of the ITRC document to frame our investigations. I see that continuing. Right now, that's the best guidance that's out there. A very good document that I highly suggest. The second line item is we've got some folks in headquarters working on a vapor intrusion database, looking at these different sites that we've completed to date and looking at the attenuation factors. And in the future, maybe 1 to 10 attenuation factor is not used. Maybe it's something else. So we're looking at the information that's out there, and that's going into a what we call a vapor intrusion database. For use. And then the last thing, I see an update to the Johnson-Ettinger model for use as well. Next slide. Okay, so that's 149 is the wrap-up of the guidance documents. And Jean, back to you. I think we're right at the two-hour mark.
Yes, you are. Congratulations, guys. I didn't think you could do 151 slides in 2 hours, but you did. Good job. I think what we're going to do is we do have a number of questions that were submitted online, and I know we still have the vast majority of our participants still here with us. So I'm going to start and we'll go about 5 to 8 minutes over the scheduled ed time to answer a few questions that have come in. And I'm going to start with some questions that were submitted online. A number of people have asked for the source for the information shown in the table on slide number 106, which is listing common indoor air chemical sources.
That was mine. Let me look at it. You know, I don't know what the source is. I don't have an answer for it. It was a slide given to me, and I do not know the source of it.
Okay. The next question came in, and a lot of these are specific to the examples, but we're going to start with some generic ones. Someone asked, do you have any recommended literature which details how to assess vapor intrusion risk from fractured bedrock with TCE contamination at significant depths?
Is that a risk assessment question, or?
Yeah, that's what they're looking at, risk from VI when you're in a in a fractured bedrock situation.
All right, I would, and they're looking for somebody to contact or a source of information.
Precisely.
I would steer them to the hydrogeologist from ERT that does our hydrogeology module here, and that's Greg Powell from the Environmental Response Team. That's his area of expertise.
Okay. Great.
I'll throw out a number. His number is 513-569-7533.
Okay, great. Thank you. There's a question that came in from the Daimler site in Dayton, which had the chlorinated hydrocarbons in groundwater. Did the investigations include solvent stabilizers such as 1,4-dioxane?
Did the investigation include other contaminants? Is that the question?
Yeah, the question said, did the investigation include solvent stabilizers such as 1,4-dioxane?
No, off the bat, I'd say no. We did look for other breakdown products, if that's where the question's coming from. We did have PCE as another contaminant, which was also coming off the site. In addition, it was coming off of up to 3 to 4 different sites as well. But we did isolate it. The main contributor was the Bayer site. But breakdown products need to be addressed as well. But specifically to your question, I don't recall that specific chemical.
Okay. The next question asks, you mentioned that for the SSD system, 1 to 2 inches of vacuum would be ideal. Can you throw some light upon how the geology would influence this value range? Let's say for a fine media, can this be achieved?
Okay, well, what we were finding out is initially the responsible parties were putting this, an off-the-shelf SSDS into a house. We were evaluating it at 30 days, 60 days, 90 days down the road, and the levels were going down, but not getting down to the screening levels that we were shooting for as the goal of the site. So in response, they increased the fan size and the vacuum pull on it, and it actually made the situation worse, and then we started seeing numbers go in the opposite direction. Initially going down in the indoor air, they were going up. So in our specific sand and gravel aquifer, we had an engineer look at the situation, and they concluded that when you're pulling too hard or too much vacuum, the makeup air is coming from somewhere. It can come from outside, below the slab, or it can be pulled off of the groundwater plume, for example. So we found that the tipping point was roughly 2 inches of vacuum pulled at the source. Anything more than that, with a shallow groundwater at 15 to 18 feet, pulling any more than 1 to 2 inches, you were actually pulling the vapors towards the house. A solution to that is keeping the vacuum low and adding additional extraction points at low vacuum. So pull the least amount of vacuum with additional extraction points was the lesson learned. Hopefully I answered that.
Okay, great. Thank you. There's just a few more. The next one is in reference to the Bayer program. Nothing was said about the impact on numerous small businesses in the neighborhood. Was anything done to monitor for the 17 part per billion SS and 1.7 part per billion IA screening levels in commercial businesses?
Yes. We have actually, what's been done, I did not mention this, but what's been done in 2009 with the Chrysler bankruptcy, they've terminated work at the site. We've actually initiated another order with the Bayer company to monitor additional locations at the site, including commercial locations. We're in the process of sampling with them right now, commercial locations. Just turned up 2 of them last week that were exceeded the subslab level of 17. So we're moving to mitigation to commercial locations. And that's in addition to what Chrysler was doing over the last couple of years as well. They were looking at commercial locations. So out of the 210 locations that have been mitigated, I would say probably 10 to 20 of those locations are commercial locations that have been mitigated. So, yes, we are addressing those at the Bayer site.
Okay, great. The next question actually comes from Italy, and they ask in reference to slide number 116, why is the Summa canister on the floor and not at about 1.5 to 2 meters high, considering the average man's height?
Yeah, I had pictures of indoor air sampling at the Bayer site back in the case study, and those were up in the breathing zone. This picture is not a good picture because it's actually too low, and I did mention that when the picture came up that I would, in this situation, have that up in the 2 to 3 foot range above the floor, and what you're trying to do is get that in the breathing zone of a child, which is a worst case scenario. So yes, this slide 116 should be off the ground.
Okay. Just 2 more questions quickly, and then we'll close things out. The next one is in reference to the Hartford site. And they asked, since the SFDS was not warranted, did you consider applying sealants in the basements to reduce intrusion?
Yes, and we did do that. The basements, as part of our needs assessments and part of our mitigation packages, would be sealed. The walls of the basement, these basements are often brick and block, and they would be sealed. The floors also would be sealed. So that was done as part of the mitigation packages.
Okay, great. Just one last question here, and I ask, is the 200 part per billion screening level in groundwater before screening soil gas a standard screening level, or is it risk-based and according to state of sites or geology? And they also ask, is 24-hour subsampling the standard amount of time, or can this be modified to shorter time periods?
I'll take the second question first. Generally, we like the 24-hour. I've seen it done in 8 hours, but you have to watch. Sometimes that'll affect your detection level. Dealing with very low levels, you need to make sure your detection level is reached with your sampling. So we like the 24-hour one better. Gene, the first question was about the 200 part per billion level. That is more of a Monday morning quarterback analysis that I looked at after the fact that that 200 parts per billion in the groundwater, in that specific geology at that site and groundwater situation, turned out to be a great predictor where the systems, where the vapor intrusion was occurring. Not recommend taking that number and moving it away from that site and trying to use that. That's just an example of that 400 rounds of data at that site that turned out to be a great prediction. So don't want to try to, don't apply that number to other sites.
Okay, great. I think with that, we're approximately 9 minutes past our scheduled end time, so I'm going to close out the formal Q&A period right now. And I want to direct everyone to slide 152, which is the last slide in the package. They'll see two links there. The first one is the links to additional resources, which will allow you to download today's PowerPoint presentation, as well as a number of the guidance documents and websites that were referred to throughout the presentation today. The second link on slide number 152 is a link to our feedback form. If you could just take a minute or two to fill that out, I do read each and every one of those submissions. And so if you found this to be valuable, that's the important way to let us know so we can continue to offer technical sessions like this for free online. If you do need a copy of an email to confirm your participation today, you can get one of those by filling out the feedback form and checking the box to get an email submission sent back to you. I want to extend my thanks to OSC Readiness, the training program, the organizers, and both of our instructors today for participating, as well as the over 250 participants we had from all over the world. Again, this session was recorded, and it will be archived on the CLUIN website in approximately 1 to 2 weeks. So if you found it was valuable, you can certainly pass it on to any colleagues of yours that might not have been able to join you today. This is the first of a number of other seminars that will be offered on CLUIN this month as part of OSC Readiness. So feel free to go out to cluin.org/training and take a look at our upcoming internet seminars. Again, thanks to everyone for joining us today, and I hope to hear from you again on a future CLUIN session. Thank you.